Every Woman is a feminist show about women making a difference and the men by their side. As 50% of the world's population and 52% of eligible U.S. voters, women are not a special interest group, and every woman should work and vote toward nothing less than 50-50 participation in social, political, economic, and environmental arenas. The opinions and views expressed on Every Woman are those of the host and guest and do not necessarily represent those of the KKFI board, staff, volunteers, or sponsors of KKFI and the Mid-Coast Radio Project Incorporated.
Good afternoon. This is Sharon Lockhart, and our show topic today is cultural appropriation. And our guests today are Celia Ruiz, why is that so difficult for me, and Diane Burkholder, both community organizers, and Amy connected with them through Professor Emily Jones, sociology professor at KU and past guest on Every Woman on gender toys. So after we hear from our shortened version of Women's E-News today, we'll be back to join this discussion on cultural appropriation.
Headline news. In a 7-7 vote, the Kansas Court of Appeals upheld a lower court's ruling that found a 2015 state abortion ban violates the Kansas Constitution. If the ruling is upheld in the Kansas Supreme Court, it will recognize abortion as a constitutional right in the state of Kansas. Kansas State Senator Mitch Holmes issued new guidelines about how women must be dressed if they wish to testify before Kansas legislature. Holmes, who is the chairperson for the Senate Ethics and Elections Committee, said he considered requiring that men wear a suit and tie, but decided men didn't need to be told how to dress professionally. A bipartisan group of female senators has expressed their outrage at this gender-specific dress code. In what is being considered the worst appropriation of the Black Lives Matter movement, Missouri State Representative Mike Moon has introduced an All Lives Matter bill aimed at strengthening Missouri's personhood laws by defining a fertilized egg as a person. Representative Moon has refused to comment on his choice of title for the act. Former Oklahoma City police officer Daniel Holtzclaw was sentenced to 263 consecutive years in prison for the rapes of 13 black women. After the sentencing, Janie Legions, the first of Officer Holtzclaw's victims to come forward, said that justice had been served. Amid boycotts of this year's Oscars over a lack of diversity in the nominations for the second straight year, the Academy has announced that it plans to make radical changes with the goal of promoting diversity. The Academy's board has stated that they wish to double the number of female and minority members by 2020.
And we're back, and we have in the studio with us Ebony Johnson, Amy Bell, our usual hosts on the air, and our guests are Diane Burkholder and Celia Ruiz, and they're going to talk about cultural appropriation. And this is a new one to me. Amy and I had a little bit of discussion. I need to know, what is cultural appropriation?
I do, too, to clarify. I think a lot of our listeners probably have no idea what this means.
Hi.
Good, so I don't feel alone.
Hi. Thank you, first of all, for having me on. I think one of the points of the discussion, I think we often have discussions about cultural appropriation, but we don't actually name it. And so I feel like a lot of us have probably felt a little uneasy when we come across some situations and aren't quite sure really what the underpinnings of that are. So basically, a cultural appropriation is when someone adopts aspects of another culture that aren't their own. So whether you're wearing attire, of a different ethnicity, of a different culture, whether your hairstyle, it could be even have to do with home decor. There's a lot of different things that can be seen as culturally appropriating other cultures.
When you say home decor, I'm picturing something that's often called British colonial.
That could be. That's not the first thing that comes to mind, but sure, I'm sure it could be considered
just
that.
Just a random assortment of things that British people might have taken from places they used to have dominion over.
Okay. So I thought you were talking about like British culture, like authentic to British culture, but you actually mean British folks that have colonized and then taken things from those cultures and then have them in
yes,
their homes.
The
yes.
Colonial
yes,
period.
Yes.
Oh, when she said that, I thought, oh my God, I've been practicing this for a long time because I have a room that has been called my tribal room, which is filled with djembe drums. It has a giraffe in it. It's had a huge picture of a lion and a desert man sleeping who happens to be of dark skin by the lion. You've seen that room, Amy. It's bamboo.
I honestly thought it was your whole house, Sherry.
Oh my gosh.
So that's why we're having this conversation.
Yeah, so hello, my name is Celia, however you want to call me, it's fine. But I guess my first thought when you said home decor is I'm thinking, I am Mexican. I was born here in the United States, but you know, born and raised in a very traditional Mexican way of thinking and living out here in East Side Kansas City. So I guess I can only speak to what I feel comfortable with, and that would be the Mexican or the Latino culture. And so then if I'm thinking of home decor, I could easily say, you know, someone has an image of La Virgen de Guadalupe. So it's the one of the Virgin Marys in Mexico and very colorful. She presented herself to Juan Diego. There's a lot of meaning behind that image. There's an entire country that, falls behind this image. And if I were to see a picture of La Virgen de Guadalupe in someone's home, I don't want to say that's not Mexican because I still want to be respectful of, you know, maybe mixed families, you know, where there is, you know, still the influence of the Mexican culture. But to have that image on a t-shirt, to have it on a pillow, and let's say I'm putting my feet on that pillow, you know, if my cats or my dogs are running around that house and they're pulling and tugging on what, you know, looks to be a cool picture, or, you know, it looks so ethnic, or my house is so colorful, and here it is that the image is being dragged across the room with such a sacred meaning for so many families. Mm. So she has been placed on pillows. She has been placed on beaded curtains. I think we've all maybe at some point seen, you know, the image of Jesus Christ on a bobblehead, you know, sitting on someone's dashboard. Or you see that in a funny, you know, or a satirical, website or a catalog. How respectful is that for, let's say, someone, you know, who is Catholic and they see a bobbling, you know, head of Jesus Christ on their dashboard? That's what it would feel like if I were to see, you know, the Virgen of Guadalupe on, you know, someone's shiny backsplash and you have oil, you know, from frying French fries and it's hitting her face. Mm-hmm. It's, you know, a lot of these images are very sacred, personal. They have history. And, you know, when those pieces are not respected, it's hurtful.
Now, I will say that I know the image that you're speaking of, and I do see it disrespected in some of those ways, not solely by people who don't participate in a Latino culture. So this message of respect, it's a very good perspective here, and it sounds like it really is coming into the grounds of this is something that everybody should be thinking about, how they respect
someone else's culture, pride, upbringing. It needs its space. It needs its respect. I guess the tone really changed right now because we started off happy, and I'm thinking, you know what? It really,
it
really does hurt.
It hurts
because you know, you could have any image, you know, that means something for you. Just like, let's say, the United States flag. It means something to you. And just as you would see someone, you know, wearing, you know, MC Hammer pants, you know, with the flag on it, you know, what does that make you feel like?
Well, and just like that, some people are perfectly okay. They think it's a celebration of the image. I mean, I know that there is a debate on making pants and mud flaps and things like that, that, you know, it's paying homage to the culture. Mm-hmm. I guess what does that argument do for this, that there is some tension by people who do operate within the same culture who have different ideas of what respect for their culture means? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think, well, you know, we're on radio, so obviously people cannot tell my ethnicity or my background or where I come from. I identify black, I'm mixed race, black and white woman. And so, and I agree with you. And I think there is a fine line between appreciation and appropriation. And for me, it really hit me when I realized that I was appropriating another culture. When I was in grad school in San Francisco in an ethnic studies program, right? And so I was in my Asian American studies class. And one of my classmates who was in the Asian American studies cohort had a rant. It was a very valid rant. And his rant was about people that have Asian decor in their homes. He's like, this stuff comes from all over. People don't even know which Asian country it comes from, right? To them, it's feng shui, or it's looking, you know, it's Chinese characters and Japanese characters. And I thought, and I was like, oh my gosh, that's me. Because I had, for the look, a very like basic classic styles, minimalist. I had many things in my home that were a mixture of Asian culture. For me, I thought that I was appreciating, but I didn't realize it. I didn't know the history of a lot of it. For me, I thought I was doing enough by not having the Chinese characters on the wall that said happiness. Cause I was like, that's cheesy and that's appropriating. Right. So I knew that that was inappropriate. But for me in the general decor, I was like, oh, that is really not helpful. And I realized that I thought I was appreciating and realized I was appropriating. For what I did is I listened to him because he was more of an expert. It hurt him. And I was like, this is not good for me to do. So I realized I was doing that myself.
Well, and when you say that, I can completely sympathize with that exact feeling, because I know that when cultural appropriation became a concept that was being talked about, I don't know how long it's been talked about, but at least when I started noticing it, for those of us who were, you know, teenagers in the late 90s, having Asian stuff was, I mean, you just weren't cool unless you had, you know, a sari and, you know, maybe even wore a dot on your head. I mean, it was an absolute cultural phenomenon in America at the time to just completely rob Asian culture for American culture. So, yes, I know that I was guilty of it myself.
And I think one question there is, you know, that can happen and it does happen, you know, because you see, let's say, Native American images on clothing, you know, indigenous designs on, you know, high fashion, you know, European, you know, styles going on. But I guess what I'm thinking is, you know, thinking about the home decor, or let's say if that was the 90s look, if a person of Asian culture were to come up to you and say, what are you wearing? You know, would you feel saying, oh, I love your people. Look what I have on. You know, I think if we so proudly wear something, if we so proudly show something, how comfortable would you be having that same attitude and that same perspective in front of someone where that means something so much to them? Would you feel comfortable saying, look at my, you know, no offense, but look at my blank room. Look at what I have here. Doesn't it look cool to you? You know, would you, you know, get nervous a little bit and say, oh my gosh, I really don't want to offend you. So would we be willing to wear and do the things that we do in front of that Native community?
One of the things that I love about America is the idea of a melting pot, and I think we're growing into that. And then even just listening to being a part of the conversation, just having, now I think we're bumping up into, there is a level of sacredness that maybe that we each need to self-reflect on and say, you know what? It isn't just that this necessarily looks cool, but maybe it actually touches you at a deeper level and you don't even realize it. And I'm not saying that there's not some, I mean, we all have some level of superficiality and, oh, I'm just, you know, but even, but in this conversation, it just, that's what I just keep thinking about. Like, we've may need to remember a sense of sacredness in each culture. And as we're becoming a melting pot that, from Black Lives Matter to All Lives Matters to every country matter, every culture matters. And so it's like understanding that what that really means to you. And then, oh, that's what the history of this image. Maybe I'll look at it differently now that I know.
Oh, I just want to, before we continue the conversation, give our phone number, because I know that you're listening out there and you're thinking, oh my goodness, I've been doing this all my life. Please help me. And the number here is 816-931-5534. We are not here to judge. We've all done this. But call in, ask your questions, join the conversation, complain about it if you'd like. If you don't agree with this, come on, disagree with us. Yeah. That's fine as well. That number is 816-931-5534. And Sharon had something to say before I interrupted her.
Yes. I'm like in defense. I'm sitting here and I'm thinking about my room. And until this man called it my tribal room, I didn't even know that it was happening, because it happened gradually. I was just drawn to things that I loved, and I purchased, you know, artwork that I loved, and a piece of furniture. I mean, well, I had the furniture, but then the other pieces came around it, and I started playing the djembe drum 15 years ago. And anybody who plays the djembe drum knows that you can't just have one drum. You've got to have a lot of drums. And it just sort of happened. I mean, and it was because I love this stuff. And part of me thinks, well, like someone said, you feel it at a deep level, you feel drawn to it.
Well, and I'm wondering if that goes back, when you have a superficial contact with that culture, when you see something at World Market or some other store that
that's
maybe
where I got my giraffe.
That. Yeah, it's a lovely giraffe.
Thank you.
But you see something and, oh, that's shiny. That would look lovely on my wall, and you have no idea what it is. Is there a difference between that and Sharon spending 15 years learning the art and history of the djembe drum and the drums that accompany it and what the custom and tradition and what the rhythms mean and how they communicate with each other? Is there a difference there?
Well, you know, I think that if you are, one, you know, I know it can feel very sensitive, and you think, what did I do wrong? You know, and it's really, personally for me, it's not about that. I think, I do believe that people have very good intentions. I believe people are good, and I'm very lovey-dovey. But if we can start having a conversation about these things, and if you're willing to learn much more beyond a design, beyond some colors, then I think that's where you really grow to have some appreciation for the other culture. For example, World Market, I love it. I love going in there. Everything does look cool. It is that superficial. I love it. But
just lost for hours in there.
Yes,
lots of shiny objects.
You can stay there forever. But, you know, my family is from central Mexico. Guanajuato, Michoacán, two central rural areas in Mexico. And I can't tell you how much I have to force myself to walk away, because I know of these pieces of the Mexican indigenous looking items at World Market, because that cute little doll that they may sell that has cute little yarn pigtails, they're adorable. I love them. But I know that I have seen a 45, 60-year-old woman sitting on the corner in Plaza Coyoacán in Mexico City, selling and making these dolls, each one by herself. I saw she was there. She has two children sitting next to her, and she's just trying to sell one of those dolls for the equivalent of maybe, say, 30 pesos. Now the Mexican dollar, or peso, is the equivalent is for a dollar. I think it went up to 19 pesos now. And if she's selling it for 30 pesos, that's less than $2 that she's selling that handmade doll.
This makes me think of not too long ago, Ebony magazine had a an article, or I think it was like maybe the cover story about people being infatuated with the black culture, mm-hmm. but not necessarily black people, actually mm-hmm. the people. You know, it's like, oh, that, I'll just mm-hmm. use an example, like hip-hop seems cool. Oh, yeah, so we'll use it over here, but not really understanding where that came from and what that means mm-hmm. to people in the African-American community. And so I think just listening to, you know, to what you said, it goes back to kind of that sacredness and things having a deeper meaning than, oh, this just looks cool for me to wear it, but being unattached to mm-hmm. the actual living, breathing human beings mm-hmm. and ways of value behind mm-hmm. it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the question is, are you willing to invest some time and some appreciation to everything else that is surrounding, let's say, that purse, you know, that design, that, you know, pictured frame? Do you really, really want to learn more about how we got to that piece? And if you are, there's plenty of people that want to talk. There's plenty of people that want to share. There's so much you can learn, even online. And I think once you have access to that information, then you make the conscious decision to say, okay, I still want to hang this up. Mm-hmm. I still want to wear this.
Yeah. I will say that I feel like the concept of cultural appropriation in this discussion has a very kind, a very good-hearted center to it. But I see a lot of people using it as, you're not allowed to do that, and you're not allowed to do that. Kind of in what I see people calling call-out culture or mm-hmm. something like that, which I think is, I think that's a bad term as well, because if you don't speak up, then it mm-hmm. seems to be silencing yeah. people. But have you seen this? Have you seen this kind of almost, you know, mudslinging
mm-hmm. yeah,
effect from this?
Well, I think it makes me think of, particularly we're talking about intent versus impact, right? And so we, like you said, you can all come from a very good place of, I just want to appreciate and show homage for, but what is the impact on that community? And what is the pain and the sacrifice? Because these have deep-rooted issues. And so, as Celia was talking about, like, particularly looking at artwork, and I do go into World Market, and I do like it, but then I also draw the line, like, those earrings are good, but do I really need them, right? Can I get them from an artist? So particularly even for, like, Indigenous cultures, and particularly in the Native community, and prints being taken out of context. I mean, Urban Outfitters all the time. I don't know if I can say brands on the air. Probably not. On the air.
It's in critique.
It's in critique. Pop culture and other stores have sold, you know, these prints, and what ways to, and if you do want to appreciate culture, find the artists that are creating that authentic work, right? Find artists that are contemporary artists. Go and support them, because that goes back into the community and the culture. And I think that goes, you know, what Ebony was talking about appropriation of black culture. I think it was Chris Rock said, everybody wants to be black until it's time to be black, right? Like, we all want, and he didn't use that word, right? But we all want, we're talking about pop culture, we're talking about particularly hip-hop and R&B, and there's been a lot of critiques about, you know, everybody that's been Grammy nominated are usually more and more becoming white folks, right? White folks doing soul and R&B, and the roots of that are Indigenous, tribal, jazz. All of that has been stolen. And at the end of the day, it's yes, people can do that work and that craft, but are we also giving and uplifting the voices and the experiences of those where it came from? And when you're talking about, particularly when you mentioned Black Lives Matter isn't saying that other lives don't matter. It means that we need to uplift and center blackness in our world, because everybody comes to black folks and takes from our culture. And then when you do kind of speak out and, you know, it's like call out culture, I do hear that. I think people do get attacked, but I think a lot of times too, like, we need to speak up, because we're taught just take it, it's fine, just appreciate it, just feel honored, it's fine, just humble yourself. This is what somebody does as presenting can be something very superficial, but it hurts to the core. It hurts me to the core when I see a non-black person wearing locks. And there's a lot of discussion about wearing dreadlocks. Like, that, black people can't wear our own hairstyles, but white folks can go and wear dreadlocks, right? And there's a, I just want to point folks to a resource. Everyday Feminism is one of my go-to sources. And there is an article written by, I wrote down, Anna Anti-Palindrome is her name. And she wrote a really good piece about this is white feminists loved her dreadlocks and why she cut them and what she thought when she had them and the process of why she even cut them. And I think, I'm going to say one last thing, I think it's really important, though, those that have appropriated and have come to this point of learning and growing, that they share that story. Because if not, you have to hear it from your peers, because if not, it's not going to do any good.
It was actually specifically that article that drew my attention to the idea of cultural appropriation. And while that article was particularly fantastic because it did talk about her own perspective and how her own perspective changed, what I did see there is the danger of spotting someone wearing dreadlocks across the room and saying, you're a white person wearing dreadlocks, and that person might not be white. And what this concept is doing to people of mixed race, or even maybe not specifically the dreadlocks thing, but I could see it expanding to other things, but also to people who are possibly in an interracial marriage where they do adopt some of the culture of their spouse.
Good. Also, back to the dreadlocks, I was thinking that dreadlocks denoted a religion more so than a culture.
And they're very spiritual for a lot of people. And even the word dreadlock itself, like I said dreadlocks just so people knew what I was referring to, but I refer to them as locks because dread is, it was created because they were considered dreadful, right? It's actually a derogatory term. So I always just say locks, twists, whatever the hairstyle is. And people that have locks take generally, you know, you take a lot of care and time. And this woman that wrote this article, she said, like, I didn't come out to create locks. She just let her hair naturally mat, and right? And that's a whole other thing. The way in which she did it wasn't even appropriate. She didn't take the time, care, and connection to even see the reasons why she did it. To her, it was just fashionable. She was edgy. You know, her clothes were tattered on purpose. You know, it was part of her appearance. It was part of her look. But at the end of the day, and this woman in particular in this article was white, at the end of the day, she still had white privilege. She could cut her hair off and be just fine. Black folks, we got this extra layer that we always have to deal with.
Yes, her journey was definitely, it was a very interesting thing to share. But like I said, I did worry about what this says to people who don't look like the ethnicity that they do, in fact, have a right to express.
I think so, to that point. You mentioned, Diane, about just taking from the community and not maybe having an appropriate sense of value and giving credit where credit is due and honor, because there have been some talks about, like, I don't know if it was in People magazine or somebody said, like, you know, maybe there were some Caucasian women wearing cornrows and, oh, they're so edgy and fashionable. And a young lady and I were talking about this and we said, well, black women, I mean, we've been doing this. That's nothing new. Mm-hmm. This is how our hair has been. So to give credit to this is edgy and cool and fashionable and a whole community has been wearing their hair that way for, I don't know, forever.
And can't do it whenever we choose.
Right. And it seemed just dismissive, you know, to call it edgy all of a sudden because someone else was doing it of another culture. But I think we're going to take a break here.
Our guests are Diane Burkholder and Celia Ruiz, and the topic is cultural appropriation. And we'll be back.
KKFI is proud to sponsor Kansas City's Winter Music Camp, February 18th through the 20th, presented by Folk Alliance International at the Sheraton Crown Center. This three-day music camp is open to all and features local, national, and international instructors such as Albert Lee and Allison Brown. Guitar, fiddle, mandolin, banjo, and many other acoustic instruments with class topics like songwriting, production, gospel choir singing, Celtic, and other folk styles. Registration and full schedule for the Winter Music Camp are at folk.org/camp.
We're
going to go to our Money Matters Minute, and we're going to piggyback on last week, continue from that, where we had three basic places you can invest your money, which was cash, bonds, and stocks. And this week for part two with Investment 101 from wiserwomen.org, Women's Institute for Secure Retirement, the topic is reasons not to put all of your eggs in one basket. Stocks. They have historically had the strongest record of high returns over the long term. In some individual years, however, bonds have the best returns. Cash investments usually provide the lowest return, but they also come with the least amount of risk of losing value. It is very hard to predict what investments will do best in any given year. You need to save your money in different investments so that you are taking advantage of the earning power of higher return investments, while also protecting some of your money in less risky investments. We will also continue this next week. For more information, go to wiserwomen.org. And we are going to air our other spot, and we'll be back to talk again about cultural appropriation. Stay tuned.
On Tuesday at 6 p.m., Radioactive Magazine host Brian Noland is joined by community activist and professor Gene Morgan and local attorney DJ Pierre, recently appointed to the Mayor's Citizens Task Force on Violence, for a discussion on crime in Kansas City, its causes, and possible solutions. That's Radioactive Magazine, Tuesday at 6 p.m. right here on KKFI.
And we're going to continue with Diane Burkholder and Celia Ruiz on cultural appropriation. And I'm not sure if we have a caller on the air or not. I think we do have a caller. Whoops. We will ask that caller to call back at 816-931-5534. And where were we in this conversation when we interrupted ourselves? Does anybody remember?
We were talking about hair, but if you could, if people are just joining us, can you say, give the definition for cultural appropriations again?
Yeah, cultural appropriation is when someone adopts a culture, adopts aspects of a culture that isn't their own. So that could be hairstyle, home decor, fashion. We can even talk about tattoos. That's a whole other discussion. We can go down the deep end if we start talking about tattoos and adornment and fashion and jewelry, body modifications. I mean, that could be a whole other show.
I believe we do have someone on the air. Caller, you're on the air. Tell us your first name and what part of town you're calling from.
St. Joseph.
Excuse me?
St. Joseph.
Oh, you're in St. Joseph? And what's your first name?
Tim.
Tim? Okay, yeah. What is your comment?
The whole thing of appropriation is something that's dismissed by a lot of people. And it's really part of a larger thing of whether or not we acknowledge history. And in relation to Our Lady of Guadalupe, one of the reason it's so significant is that prior to that event or that moment in history, there was a thing called the Doctrine of Discovery, and which just permitted the murder of a lot of people. And so when we see that image, we don't really think about its impact upon history, how it changed that trajectory. And so I think in the case of a lot of imagery, we put it out there, but we don't recognize its historical context.
That's a very good point. I knew nothing about that. Anybody want to comment on that?
I think that comes again back to, you know, investing that time and wanting to learn more about it. So I absolutely appreciate that feedback because there is so much more to it.
Thank you, Tim. Did you have anything else you wanted to add?
That was it. I just wish people would recognize or be aware of history a little bit more.
I would agree with you. Absolutely, 100%. All the histories out there, history majors out there, unite.
Thank you.
You know, earlier today, my partner and I were having a conversation that when you have access to information or you have access to an opportunity, that's your responsibility to step it up. So if we're talking about this now, and again, no one's in trouble, you know, it's what we do with this information. And so then let's say if I knew nothing about locks before, but I heard this information today, and if I don't believe it, I can probably look it up online and, you know, into some legitimate, you know, sources. Again, I was given the access and the opportunity to do something with it.
So this is kind of the focus of KKFI, is to educate and stimulate. So what you're saying is we're doing our job today.
We are.
By having this discussion on air. And do we have another caller?
We do have another caller. They're trying again. The line was just no sound coming from their end. I have a question, though. And this is where it gets really dicey to me, is white culture, what is it? It's hard to define. Sometimes when you do define it, it looks an awful lot like it's actually based on stealing things from other cultures. So I'm sure you've discussed this before. They've got this look on their face that says... It says, oh, this question again.
I might have had this conversation
a couple times today before I got here.
I think kind of your point goes back to what Ebony was saying earlier about this country being, you know, a melting pot. This country was founded on stealing, you know, rape, pillage, and stealing other people's culture and telling people that and killing people because their culture was not appropriate, right? And making people adopt and force another culture. And when we look at communities now and new immigrants now and this push for assimilation, and assimilation is just be seen, quote unquote, as white as possible. So you're, quote unquote, mainstream. And I think part of the discussion about talking about white culture is white folks are, I think, now digging deeper about what it means to be white and what whiteness is, because oftentimes we talk about race and ethnicity, we look at quote-unquote other cultures and ethnic, those other ethnicities, and white folks have made to be white. And so white folks have lost their own culture about whether they're Scottish or British or Australian, or well, actually not Australian because Indigenous folks were there first, right? Looking at what people had to get rid of their cultures to order to become more powerful and to become white. And so I think that could be a whole other topic of what whiteness is. And I've had conversations with many white folks around town. They're doing anti-racist work about, like, how do we as white people talk about what whiteness is, and how do we engage in working with communities of color to make sure that we are uplifting and supporting those communities as much as possible without taking up so much space.
Well, I've also read some really good work on how to be a white person who's not racist, because it's challenging even when you're trying, because white privilege just exists. It's just happening. And one of the things that it said was an early stage of wanting to come to the table for a white person was to kind of go through a bit of a crisis where they don't see their own culture, mm-hmm. and they reach desperately for other cultures. And part of white appropriation of culture may actually be the beginning of recognizing that there should be more. Mm-hmm. And have you heard that before?
Yeah, I think everybody goes through their process. And I think no matter what kind of, you know, privilege we're talking about, male privilege too, right? Like we all come from different places. And part of when you start to unearth, oh no, this could be me, it's this crisis. And I want to prove as much as possible that I am, quote unquote, not that person. And people don't want to be given the R label for being racist. Men don't want to be given the S label for being seen as sexist, right? And I think part of it is moving through that, because when that happens, we end up centering our feelings, right? And so it all still becomes about us, right? And in our place of privilege. And so how do we humble ourselves and just listen? I think that is, you know, somebody was talking about that too. You just listen, take the space, learn on your own. Yes, you can ask some people for some guidance, but it also becomes emotional labor when communities of color or other communities have to then do all the work for these other folks, when the work should be really upon the person that sits in that place of privilege. And I think that really talks about entitlement, really forcing, and that my narrative is what needs to be centered here. And part of unpacking our privilege is talking about this sense of entitlement, and that we don't always deserve everything we think we get.
And we do have a caller, Donna Wolf. You're on the air. If you'd like to tell us where you're calling from.
She's outed.
I'm calling from 169 South, headed your way. I just wanted to comment on the discussion that's going on, which is a wonderful thing for us to be having, by the way. But it's about white privilege and entitlement and how not to be racist if you're white. And this is a sort of occurrence that I have experienced multiple times. And I think it speaks to white privilege. And anyway, so I have locks, naturally curly black people's hair, long. And many, many times I have been asked by white men in general, quote, how long does it take to get your hair like that? And I find it galling and insulting and intrusive and always wonder what gives them the right to question me about my hair as if it's some sort of anomaly, obviously marking the difference between my hair and their hair and treating it as if it's some sort of curiosity that they are privileged to comment on. So my response the last few times has been, you know, it's inappropriate to ask me about my hair. It makes me feel like you're treating me differently than you would any other woman. Do people ask your wives, your girlfriends, about how long it takes to do their hair? So just some feedback on that point of view would be appreciated. Thanks.
Thank you, Donna.
I'm nodding my head because I have threatened to get a shirt that said, don't touch my hair. Yeah, I think, first of all, thank you for sharing that because that is a point of vulnerability and it hurts. Right? You've gone through this time and time again. And I think particularly black women, depending on our hairstyle, but most of the time, any type of hairstyle we have, we are a point of speculation. And we know that black women around the world throughout history have been seen as spectacles, have literally been put in zoos. And so when people ask questions like that, it brings all of that up. But I think you had a really good point of like, we often get stuck when asked those questions. And I think, you know, unfortunately, we got to go through it time and time again. What is our rebuttal, right? Because, but also too, we don't necessarily always have to say something back, but it hurts, but it's taking back that power. And to not necessarily to speak your truth and then just keep it moving.
And I think it's just important, like you said, our rebuttal, like how best can I really respond to this? Because in some ways, I mean, if you're ignorant about a matter, get educated. And so I do invite you to, you know, I think it's that's how we get to know each other is to ask questions. But at the same time, I think there's a certain level of sensitivity and respect that should be given when you're asking somebody about something so personal.
And, well, and you know, I have a quick question or a quick thought right here also is that some of us, we get really tired. Mm-hmm. We're tired of educating other people. Mm-hmm. I want you to learn. You know, if I had the time and the energy to keep educating you, I would. Mm-hmm. But I'm a regular person, and we do get tired.
Mm-hmm. Our guests are Celia Ruiz and Diane Burkholder, community organizers who are doing a fantastic job of educating us about cultural appropriation. And if you'd like to call in,
we have a caller here.
Okay.
Caller, you're on the air.
Yes.
Could you state your name and where you're calling from?
It's Blind Guy calling from the Villa Incognito here in Midtown. I love the thing on decor. And Donna, since it's probably a white guy asking about your hair. Oh, and Donna, I didn't realize you were African-American. But anyway, and that's part of being blind. But say, how long did it take you to get that fabulous comb over? But your comment on decor of, like, black paintings on black velvet, and I'll take my answer off the air. Peace out.
Black velvet paintings like Velvet Elvis's is what I'm picturing right now.
Not quite sure of the question.
Well, I think that the king deserves some due respect from time to time.
I'm thinking that perhaps the idea was that I can kind of remember seeing pictures on corners, velvet paintings that might have been depicting bullfights and things like that, that might have been more ethnic toward the Mexican or Latin influence. And maybe that's what he's talking about.
Well, you know, and I think this is coming back to a question that you talked about, is that where is the white culture? So rather, I'm thinking then, is this conversation leading to what's missing from your prideful culture? But like, what's missing from your culture that you have to get it from someone else?
I think everything is missing. Here's my point. Back in 92, I went to Thailand, my first experience abroad, and it was just a mind-blowing experience to see the poverty that's not separated and hidden from view. Right next to a gold-inlaid palace could be the most destitute of homes. And I just was amazed at how they were so proud of their culture and their dance and how they did it everywhere and showed us. Of course, I was on a kind of an exchange program with University of Missouri Extension Center, and then Thai women came to the U.S. and visited with us. But we have no, I don't think we have any culture.
Well, I'm Scottish and I golf.
You know, which...
I own a kilt. I do own a kilt. I will say that. And I actually own a set of bagpipes. I do not know how to play them, and the kilt no longer fits me.
Well, my background is mostly Scottish, Irish, and English, and I have nothing that I think that is anything about any of that.
Well, and you know, another thought is, you know, we I'll speak of at least my family or my community. I cannot speak for others. We've worked really, really hard to hold on to what we have. Mm-hmm. We've held in within, you know, my partner and I, we were talking about the Spanish language. You know, we were talking about our foods. We were talking about, yes, our decor, which it's the bright, beautiful colors that I've always wanted in my house, you know, or, you know, the music that we're listening to in the house, or everything that embodies our relationship, our plans as a family. We fight every single day to make sure that it's 100% loud, untainted, and us. And so I think it's unfair and disrespectful for someone else or another community to come in and take apart those pieces that we have strategically worked on to preserve. And I think that's something that we need to think about as we poke apart, you know, other cultures or other communities, because people work really, really hard to make something authentic and real.
I would agree. I think that the world would be sadly different if we did completely become this one global culture. That would be, we would have lost something if that happened.
Mm-hmm. And I think sometimes that this was something that maybe a few years ago, the idea for me that sometimes both things are true. And in this discussion, meaning that there's a sense of equality, and then you can also be unique as well at the same time. You know what I mean? So it's like we can speak about black culture, we can speak about Mexican culture, we can speak about Hispanic culture, and all of those things have a uniqueness, and at the same time, they have a sameness to them as well. And so it's not one or the other. And a lot of times, I think we've been in that boat of, well, you've got to be this or that. You can't be both, mm-hmm. or it can't, you know what I mean? It can't be that way. And so in some regards, I feel like on one hand, we can be afraid of, oh, I'm going to lose a part of my heritage and who I am if I just melt away into this melting pot. And then on the other hand, it's like, well, everybody needs to be the same. And it's like, well, maybe both things are true. You know, when you're cooking something, all of the seasonings are in that dish. You know what I mean? It's all there, but it comes together as one, and each has a distinct flavor. And I feel now more than ever some of the richness that we're missing, that we're trying to make up for by purchasing things or, you know, doing a lot of material stuff, is some of this kind of a conversation where it's like, oh my gosh, the history that you've just exposed us to is fascinating, is interesting. And, you know, to admire another culture is something that I think we really want, but maybe are having a hard time getting there in mm-hmm. some ways.
Well, I think that also ties into
I think this conversation also invites us to look at our own history. You know, you're saying you're Scottish and Irish, right? And so, you know, like this opportunity, and I'm sure you've had opportunities, and you have to a certain extent to go and, like, you know, learn about the history and learn about how the cultures have worked here and how your families have met. And also, too, there's been discussion in the Black community about, like, can Black people appropriate Blackness? Can we appropriate Africanness, right? Africa, right? All those countries, right? The continent of Africa. But part of it, too, is Black folks are reclaiming and getting more in touch with our indigenous roots in within tribes in Africa and within contemporary African culture. And so that's also a part of it. Like, it invites people to look deeper within us. And also, too, I just want to add this to the point, is it's also, too, it's not white folks necessarily always appropriating from communities of color. Like, Pharrell got a lot of heat last year when he was on the cover, mm-hmm. I believe, of a popular Black magazine. He had a headdress on, an indigenous headdress, and that is very sacred, right? And so we also need to, part of it is, you know, quote-unquote call-out culture. We need, our own people do it to other communities, and when that happens, like, I think it's just as important, because I think a lot of times we give particularly communities of color, you know, a kind of a pass, and it's still not okay.
Well, you know, talking about having more of a roots culture, where, you know, that very ancient culture, mm-hmm. that your family carries with it, whether mm-hmm. you know about it or not. As a person who studied history, really loves history, believes it's very important, I hear you talk about Black people reclaiming their African culture, and I'm thinking, would it ever have to have been framed that way if we learned African history the way we learned European history? Because we go to school and we learn European history, mm-hmm. and we don't have to reclaim that culture because we're indoctrinated with that mm-hmm. culture. And the only reason that there's even a discussion about reclaiming African culture is because it was abandoned by public school.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Is there a caller?
And I actually was also, you know, tying that into with African History Month coming up in February. Insanely inadequate.
Africa, like Women's History in March.
Yeah. People have been in Africa longer than any other place in the world. And more than that, like, ignoring the time span that it's the shortest month of the year, my school days, it was Martin Luther King, I Had a Dream speech, George Washington Carver made peanut butter. Mm-hmm. And maybe Rosa Parks.
Yeah.
Maybe. And it wasn't until I was in college that I learned any Black history. Mm-hmm. And it was an eye-opener. It was like, so all of these things happened. We've done absolutely nothing to heal or fix this. Mm-hmm. And more things keep happening, and there's just this chain of events, and we're not breaking the chain. Mm-hmm. And if they taught that in school, this conversation might start earlier.
Mm-hmm. And I think also the level of culture appropriation wouldn't be as great as it is, because we would understand and have more of a understanding growing up versus mm-hmm. us trying, because I think people are trying to learn about other cultures, and they don't know how to do it because they haven't been taught how to do it. They haven't been given the resources. And what's most accessible is pop culture and things in stores. And so we see Absolutely. That as our way of learning. And that's yeah. the top down. It should be the bottom up the way we learn.
Absolutely. And I don't know. It feels like they think that teaching Black history is harmful because it will poison the children against the culture that they're in. That's the idea that it sounds like. And it was really eye-opening. It was really fascinating. We started learning about all these people that had absolutely the exact same level of accomplishment as the white people they taught us about, but they just never said their names, so they were never household names.
Remind me again about the film tonight on the Oprah Network.
Oh, it's not you, it's men.
Thank you. It's not you, it's white men might be an appropriate thing, because they are controlling what's in the textbooks largely. And that's the reason. And white men are very frightened because we're becoming a browner society. I mean, for years we've been becoming browner. And that's very frightening for them to be a minority.
How many years now we're in the countdown to white minority?
Oh,
still
about 40.
We look at globally, though, white people are already the minority, 5% of the world population.
Is that right?
Yes.
I've never heard that. That's amazing.
And in 2018 in California, won't it change? The youth there, it will switch.
It will switch. In California, in L.A. County, has been over 60% Latino for years. So I don't even use the word minority when I'm talking about people of color.
I've always suspected that part of the fear is that when white people are the minority, they maybe are afraid that now they're going to be treated like a minority.
But, you know, I think, you know, speaking then of, you know, I'll speak of the, you know, Mexican or the Latino culture, is that we love to share. We really, really love to share what is authentic and what is truly us. So, you know, white men or white communities should not feel like, oh my gosh, well, we are ready to share. We really want you to be a part of this. But just respect us and listen to us before you pick us apart.
Well, thank you for joining us. This has been a very deep we've really kind of like punched straight through this concept, although I think we could probably do it again sometime if you're up for it.
We can talk about holidays next.
And Halloween. I just wanted to give, I know we're closing out, just a couple of resources. Everyday Feminism, like I mentioned before, does all kinds of intersectional feminist work, talks about cultural appropriation. 18 Million Rising is an organization that works with the Asian Pacific Islander community. Also, STARS is a group that does a lot of work about Halloween. My culture is not a costume. They're out of Ohio University, and it stands for Students Teaching About Racism. And also Native Appropriations is a really good website. And Tate Walker, I'm just going to plug her. She's a friend. She does amazing discussions and works about Native Appropriation.